You know, it's funny, when we finished the Fifth Way series, actually it's getting to be 3 weeks ago, it was kind of like me finishing high school. I had no idea what I was going to do next. And it's just kind of that panic. It's, oh, my, what do we do next? Fortunately, I had a couple of weeks to think about it. And I thought I knew where I was going this week. And then as the week progressed, it kind of derailed me. And so I kind of want to go in a different direction. It's been interesting that through the course of the questions that we had over the last 2 weeks of conversations, for some of you who weren't here, it was just asking questions and going back and forth, whether on the material that we've been covering for the last few months or not. But the question that keeps coming up over and over again is the question of suffering. You know, why do we have to suffer? What is it about suffering? And does it always have to be? And aren't we supposed to be getting beyond it at some point, you know, in our spiritual journeys? And all these questions that keep coming up. And then there was the week that I had this week. I should say the week that Marion and I had this week. You know, it's just one of those weeks where it's just like, what else could go wrong? You know, both of our cars are going sideways on us and they need to go in to the shop. The fence was completely rotted so that we got to go halfies with our neighbors, you know, and get the fence redone. And then we had to face probably the two most frightening words in the English language, slab leak. For those of you who know, yeah, I hear some groans out there. That's a leak inside the concrete slab. And so it's just crazy. So at one point, oh, and then the oven went out. So at one point, I think it was on Thursday, we had three different crews out here trying to fix the plumbing, trying to then dry everything out that had gotten soaked inside. So now all the drywall is pulled out, the cabinetry downstairs is pulled out, the flooring is pulled out, and we've got like 10 hot air blowers and dehumidifiers and all this stuff going on. And to top it all off, Marion's cousins from Oregon are coming down here. And we got no downstairs bathroom, and it's just, you know, okay. And then in the midst of all of that craziness, our 15-year-old Boston Terrier, Bonnie, just took a huge nosedive, and we had to put her to sleep on Wednesday. And, wow, that was more emotional than I expected. I thought I was ready for it because she's been going downhill for at least a year. She was blind, she was deaf, her hips were going out. But there was never a time when we thought that she was really in pain, and she seemed to have good days, and she was still eating even though she was continuing to lose weight. But yeah, she just went right down, and we just knew when it was time. And so in the midst of all this other craziness, I still have the image of her face. And I was holding her head when the injection went in, and just a look on her face, and I can still see myself closing her eyes, and it was just a very emotional thing for us. And then telling the boys and everything, was like one of those weeks. And Marion and I are looking at each other and saying, you know, is there some sort of cosmic, you know, plan here? Or, you know, how does this all happen? You know, now in the scheme of things, is that really suffering? Well, wise man once told me that any problem that can be fixed with money is not a problem. You know, I kind of like that. I like that because it keeps things in perspective. You know, no amount of money could have saved Bonnie from the fate that we're all going to face. But money can fix the other things and they'll be back to normal. And you know, it was interesting that through this, I had this other part of my brain that was keeping flashing back on Barbara, who is the woman that we prayed for last week, those of you who are here. And she has been diagnosed with cancer that is inoperable, and it looks to be terminal. And she's she was told 2 months ago that she had 2 months, and she's still walking and she's still hanging in there. She texted me this morning to say that she's sorry she couldn't make it this morning, but she had a bad day and not much sleep last night. Now that's suffering, see? And if I look at that and I keep this in perspective, and then as a pastor, you know, the pastors can tell you, boy, we get the privilege of being a part of so many lives in our community, but there is so much pain and suffering and so many traumatic things that are happening just in this room that you would probably be amazed unless you're one of them. And you know the kind of pain and you know the kind of suffering that is going on. You know, it's really amazing that we can, sometimes I tell people, I'm amazed that you're sitting upright in the chair telling me the story. You know, it's just like, how does that work? How do we do this? You know, how do we face suffering? How do you face suffering? You know, even from the more, you know, trivial to the sublime, from the ridiculous. I mean, how do you face it? When these things happen, when these things start piling on, when things really hit you, I mean, what's your reaction? How do you face it? You know, There's always the tendency to want to rage at the universe and scream at God and say, why am I being victimized? And what is wrong? You know, what did I do to deserve this? That kind of attitude and feeling beaten down. And, you know, or feeling cursed. You want to blame the devil for all of this? That's one. And maybe the devil is in charge here and just piling all this stuff on. Do we get angry? Do we get depressed? You know, what is the reaction that we typically have to suffering? You know, I suppose we wonder why it has to be this way. That was the gist of a lot of the questions that we got. Why does there have to be a base of suffering in this life? Is it supposed to be that way? Typically, the church is telling us no, that there's supposed to be a base of prosperity and tranquility. You know, on the other hand, Jesus said, I didn't come to bring you peace. And the word that he used there meant calm and tranquility, but the sword. And so what is supposed to be a reaction here? Does God give us the suffering? I mean, that's the other big question. Does God give us this suffering? Is there a reason that he gives it to us? Is it for correction? Is it for chastisement or punishment? I mean, what is the reason? And one of the questions that we had a couple of weeks ago, you know, led me to make the statement that I don't believe that anything bad comes from God. I don't believe that God gives us suffering. God is the sole source of everything that we would consider good. He's pure unity. He's pure connection. And if we move into his presence, that's what we get, is connection, is unity, is acceptance. You know, the things that are difficult in our lives generally are the results of our own actions, the results of the actions of others, or just stuff that happens. You know, ovens do wear out, you know. And so do dogs. They just wear out. And so do we. You know, and so that is not necessarily evil or good or bad, but it causes suffering in us because of the sense of loss of these things that we have loved and things that we are at least used to. Does God do that to us? No, I don't believe that he does. But God isn't off the hook either because he allows it, right? He's not taking it away from us. And so how are we supposed to process this? How are we supposed to face pain and suffering? Well, there was a friend of mine who said, you can know a good restaurant by the way that they can handle potatoes. You know? And I thought that was the weirdest statement to hear. But when I thought about it, when you go for breakfast, you know, the way that they do the potatoes, because potatoes are just bland, they're neutral. But the way you season them and the way you do them, if you can do that for potatoes, then all the rest of the stuff is gravy. I think he's right. You know, judge the potatoes first and then you can see the way they do the rest. I suppose you can judge a baseball player by the way they can handle a curve. You know, a lot of guys can hit a fastball, but can you hit a curve? You know, and I've heard that golfers can be judged by their putting. You know, it's about the putting. That's where the game is won or lost. I don't know if all that stuff is true, but it's the way my mind works. Because what I do know is that we can know a human being by the way that they handle suffering. That's where it comes down to. That is where the rubber meets the road. How we handle suffering, how we handle the pain in our lives, says volumes about who we are and who we become. I'm sure that it's the mark of spiritual maturity to be able to handle suffering, not that it doesn't hurt, but to handle it in a way that is still unifying, is still inclusive, that still brings relationships together. Can we do that? Can we move through these difficulties and still be that kind of force in the lives of the people around us? I think that's how we know who we are. What drew me to recovery in the first place, you know, was the fact that suffering is a great leveler. Think about it. You know, no matter where you are, what station you are in life, everybody comes to the place of suffering in the same way. And they can understand each other through that suffering. Even if their accidents of birth and even if all of the details of their life are vastly different, this is something that brings us together and unifies us as human beings. And that's what attracted me to recovery and 12-step work, is when I moved into it, I realized that in a community church setting, we had the luxury, the ability to be able to put on faces and to move out of what we perceived as suffering enough to have different levels. But in AA, the suffering was so present, it was so at the surface, that everybody was kind of leveled. It made them vulnerable. It made them humble. It made them transparent to each other. There was no artifice. There was no guile. And I love that. Because right at that point is where change is really possible, where true change is imminent in that immediacy, in that feeling. And suffering brings all this to the surface, and I recognize that, you know? Ever met someone who seems to have led a charmed life? Just seems like, you know, they're Teflon. Nothing ever really sticks to them. And they've been able to go through their lives kind of in a straight line and get to some great place in life. Don't you hate people like that? But the point is, if you know someone like that, there's also another side to them. It seems that they can't connect with those of us who have really been broken. They don't get it. They don't understand. Maybe there's not a lot of compassion there. There's not a lot of ability to give grace, I suppose, for those of us who have not been able to move in that straight line and get where we want to go. There's a book that was written a few years ago called The First Rate Madness. I don't know if you've ever heard of that one before. But the premise of the book was interesting. It was written by a prominent psychiatrist who looked in history at all the great leaders, the leaders of crises in our history. And every one of them, as he was looking at it, had some sort of mental defect, some sort of mental illness. You know, he looked at Lincoln, for example, who was a mess in terms of, clinically depressed and possibly bipolar, and yet what he was able to do during the Civil War. Churchill was the same way. Kennedy was the same way. And then when he looked at men or women who were supposedly really sane, super sane, these are the people like Neville Chamberlain or Herbert Hoover who couldn't deal with the crises in their leadership roles and couldn't connect with the people. Herbert Hoover couldn't connect with people who had to live in Central Park because they had no money and they had no jobs. This is something that was so out of his experience. And so he's saying there's something about having suffered. There's something about having been broken by something in life that contributes to the ability to be there for other people in their broken times and in their crisis. You know? How does Jesus put it? Take a look at Matthew 5:4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Second of the Beatitudes there, right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, in order to really get what Jesus is saying here, we have to consider that word mourn a little bit. Because we have one idea, just colloquially, of what mourning is. You know, somebody dies and we cry for them, we mourn for them. But in Aramaic, the word there is abal. And abal really means confusion. It means turmoil. It can mean to be wandering somewhere. Looking deeply for something to occur, either literally or figuratively. It also means to be made weak, to be made even desperate from want of this thing to occur. In other words, to be broken. That's what Jesus is talking about. Blessed are you who are broken. Now that sounds weird to us. Blessed are you? And that word blessed, tobei in Aramaic, means everything from being blessed to enriched, whole, complete. Congratulations to you. Fortunate are you when you're broken. It's counterintuitive to us. But take a look at the way that Eugene Peterson translates that in the Message. He does such a good job. You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you. Only then can you be embraced by the one most dear to you. I love that. See, here there's a truth buried in here that Jesus is trying to get us to see, is that we can't know who we are until we know who we are not. We can't know who we are until we know who we aren't. And this is so true. Because until we've been broken, until we have experienced the fact that we can't fend for ourselves, we really are powerless in the face of so many things in life. That we really have gifts that we need given to us that we cannot give ourselves. Until we start to understand we're not God. Until we start to understand that we're not self-sustaining. Until we start to understand that we really are dependent. That we really are in the receiver position and not in the giver position. Until we get that, we're not going to have a clue who we really are. We're going to be locked into this egoic, false sense of ourselves, that voice that talks to us in our head and tells us all this stuff constantly, that is simply a product of all of our turmoil and all of our traumas and all of our hurts. It's just programs for survival, programs for happiness that we've cooked up in our own head, and we needed them when we were going through those traumas, but they're not who we are. And until that gets broken, until that gets just chipped and laid aside, we're never going to have the sense of who we really are. Blessed are you when you get confused, when you move into turmoil, when you're wandering. Because what that means is that everything that you thought you knew about yourself has been stripped away. And this is the prime moment, the perfect time to be able to be filled in with something that is true about who we really are. Because it's connected to who God really is. When we clear all that out, what's left, however improbable, must be true. It's the way it works. And Jesus is trying to get us to understand this. You know? He's trying to get us to understand how this works. When we've finally been broken, when we finally have this connection, it changes our relationship with everyone else. I've told some of you the story before, but it's so perfect, I got to tell it again. A few years back, the founder, co-founder of The Effect and I got a call from a woman whose son had been popped for heroin distribution and use and consumption, and he was in Central Jail in Santa Ana, and she asked if I would go visit him, and I said, sure. And my friend Jeff asked if he could come along. He said, absolutely. And so we went together, and we're sitting there across the glass, and he's in his orange jumpsuit, and we pick up the phones. And since I got the call, I sat down first, and I'm talking to this young man, early 20s, and he's looking down at his hands. And after about 5 minutes of talking to him, I can't get him to look up. There's no eye contact. And I'm a normie. I should probably let you all know that. My friend Jeff says, can I sit down? Now, Jeff's a heroin addict. He sat down at that phone, and I kid you not, within 90 seconds, he had eye contact. He had the kid's head going up and down. He made a connection there. There's something about having gone through this difficulty, this trauma, that gives you an authenticity, gives you a vocabulary, I guess. I don't know what he said that I didn't say, you know, but it connected with him. There was something in his tone of voice, in the words that he chose, in what he said to him, that suddenly he knew this was someone who had been there, someone who had done that, someone who could understand, not judge, because they were in the same boat rowing together. As much as I wanted to do that, I couldn't get there. I wasn't broken in that way. I was broken in other ways, and I could connect with people that Jeff couldn't. That's what makes the world go round. But if you're not broken at all, or if you don't have the awareness that you've been broken at all, then you have the luxury to be able to have these idealized sort of, you know, utopias in your mind that connects. In fact, let's take a look at the way Rohr puts it. Richard Rohr, this is out of the book that is ever going on Wednesday nights. Listen to what he says here. We must resist all utopian ideologies and heroic idealisms that are not tempered by patience and taught by all that is broken, flawed, sinful, and poor. You know, when you read someone who's a real mystic like Rohr is, sometimes his words just kind of go out there, you know. But there's something really central here. Let me read that again. We must resist all utopian ideologies and heroic idealisms that are not tempered by patience and taught by all that is broken, flawed, sinful, and poor. Jesus is an utter realist and does not exclude the problem from the solution. Think about that for a second. Jesus is an utter realist, does not exclude the problem from the solution. Jesus wasn't giving us just theories. He wasn't even giving us an ideology. And Jesus wasn't talking about something that he had not experienced himself. What do you think that time in the wilderness was all about? What do you think happened there? When the New Testament says something as simple and concise as he was exhausted and he was hungry, read between the lines of what was going on there. Jesus was pushed to his absolute limit. Those three temptations that he faced, turn stones into bread, bow down before me and take control of the world's governments, throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple and have the angels lift you up. are the basic three obsessive drives that we as humans all face. It's the need for relevance. It's the need for power. It's the need for attention. You know, to be spectacular. Jesus had to work through all of those, just like every single one of us has to work through all of those. Those are the emotional programs for happiness. Right? As kids, when we are truly victimized, what do we need? You know? We need food. We need control. We need attention. We need love. Those are the basic things that drive us. But the programs that we put in place to get through those times stay in place long after that they are needed. And then they color everything. Now they're the voice in our head that tell us who we think we are until that gets broken. Until you allow it to be broken. See yourself as broken. Then you can't move into this new phase. This is what Jesus is talking about. When he came out of that desert, when he came out of the wilderness, he was reborn. He wasn't even asking Nicodemus to do anything that he hadn't done himself. He was a new creature. Is that Jesus? Hey, I'm just telling you what the scriptures say. Luke 2 says he grew in wisdom and stature. He had to move through his life, learn through his life. This is real stuff. And when he tells us about this way of living life that brings us into connection with the Father, it's not theoretical either. And it's not told from some ivory tower. He's down in the dirt with us, showing us how it's done, modeling it day by day. Oh, this is Jesus' absolute humility and genius at the same time, showing through to us. He doesn't exclude the problem from the solution. He's not just giving airtight solutions for us. He's showing us how it works out in real time. Never expect or demand perfection on this earth. It usually leads to a false moral outrage, a negative identity, intolerance, paranoia, and self-serving crusades against a contaminating element instead of becoming a new creature, a new creation ourselves. Wow. Don't you wish Roy would just say what he thinks? Never expect or demand perfection on this earth. That almost sounds immoral to us. Aren't we supposed to do that? No. When we think of perfection, we think without error. There is a perfection that Jesus tells us we can have. That's the perfection, the connection, the complete immersion in this moment. That's perfect. That's fulfilled. But it doesn't mean it's going to be without error. In our unbroken minds, as we think we see them, we have this ability to set a standard in our head, the way that things are supposed to be for us, for others, for family, for church, for nations, for everything. And then we judge everything against that. Exactly what Jesus told us not to do. Don't bring this standard in, because the standard that you use to judge others is the one that's going to judge you. You're already living under that crucifix, you're under that cross, under that weight. Because that's the way you think it's supposed to be, instead of allowing the moment to be what it is and finding the connection within it. That's perfection, as Jesus would talk about it. But this constant expecting something other than is gives us all of these effects that Rohr is talking about. How does Jesus put it? Right there, Matthew 16, verse 24. He said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." And again, listen to the way Peterson paraphrases that. Then Jesus went to work on his disciples. I love that right from the beginning, right? Jesus went to work on his disciples. "Anyone who intends to come with me has to let me lead. You're not in the driver's seat. I am. Don't run from suffering. Embrace it. Follow me, and I'll show you how. Self-help is no help at all. Self-sacrifice is the way, my way, to finding yourself, your true self." That idea, for whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, he's saying self-help is no help at all. Are you self-actuating? Are you the self-sustaining one? Are you the one who's always in the giver position? Then you're unbroken, and you can't be taught. You can't see anything new outside of everything that is the way that it's supposed to be, or that you're working diligently to make it that way. These are deep truths that Jesus is trying to get us to understand, to see. Why take up the cross? Why embrace suffering? Sounds kind of Catholic to me. I grew up Catholic. It was all about the suffering. All about that. And the more you suffered, the closer you were to Christ. You know? It's funny. I think Jeanette is still out there. I think it was Jeanette was telling me that maybe it was somebody else. Doesn't really matter. But anyway, she had the audacity to wear her crucifix around her neck. Now that's a cross with the corpus with the body still on it into an evangelical church. And she said she got a lot of flack for that. And one of them said, take Jesus off the cross. We need the wood. That was a shock to me when I first walked into an evangelical church and there was a cross, but there was no body because I grew up Catholic. And the body was always there to remind us of the suffering. You know, the Protestants took the body off the cross, partly to stick a finger in Rome's eye and the Pope's eye, but the other part of it was to focus us on the resurrection as opposed to the crucifixion. It's good, but that doesn't mean that we whitewash the suffering. It doesn't mean that we pretend that there's not supposed to be any suffering, that our lives are supposed to go in that straight line from here to there. You know, there still is an emphasis on suffering in Jesus' teaching, and we need to see how that works. Once again, when Jesus says take up the cross, he's speaking metaphorically. It's okay, we can say that out loud, right? When Jesus says eat my flesh and drink my blood, he's speaking metaphorically. He's speaking spiritually. When he says you must be born again, and Nicodemus thinks he has to crawl back into his mother's womb, he's speaking metaphorically. When he says you need to drink this living water so you never have to thirst again, and the Samaritan woman is confused and says, yeah, I don't want to have to keep carrying this bucket from the village every day. It's metaphorical. Jesus is talking about killing that egoic false self, letting it go. Who we think we are has to die. Paul calls it the old man. The old man has to die. The old woman has to die. We have to hang them up on the cross and let them go. Because as long as they are filling ourselves, as long as they are who we think we are, we can't get any further than that. This is what Jesus is talking about. How does that happen? How do we let go of the old man? How do we crucify that person? Through suffering. I don't know that it works any other way. How many of us voluntarily give up power? How many of us voluntarily just tear down everything that we think is our safety net, is our teddy bear, security blanket, our program for survival? Normally it has to be taken from us. Or at least it has to be working so poorly that we finally realize, yeah, we need a new vehicle here. You know, call out the repairman. But some sort of pain, some sort of suffering is always the catalyst for change. The good times don't change anything. It's the difficulties. It's the negative responses and emotions that are the motivators for something else to happen. This is what Jesus is trying to get us to understand. There is a shape to our spiritual journey. Every one of us, with all the different individual details that we're going to have as we follow this journey, there is an overall shape that is the same for each one of us. And thank God, because if there was no commonality between us, how in the world could we even talk to each other? It wouldn't make any difference whether we read the scriptures or not, or read some of the great people who have come through in our church history. They would have nothing to teach us. They would have nothing to show us. But there is a shape to the journey. Christians have called it for centuries the Paschal Mystery. And I know that also sounds Catholic. In the liturgy of the Mass, we used to say at one point in the Eucharist, Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. That's the shape of this Paschal Mystery. And Paschal, what is it? What is a Paschal Mystery? Paschal is just our word for the Hebrew word Pesah, or the Aramaic word Pascha, which means to pass over. Pesach is the feast of Passover for the Jews. Jesus' Passion Week, Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection happened during Passover, during Pesach. And so the Paschal Mystery is this shape, this death, this burial, this moving down into the tomb, and then rising again. That shape that is the key to every single spiritual journey that we are ever going to take. Every spiritual journey that any human being takes, there always has to be a descent before there's an ascent. There always has to be a flushing before there can be a filling. There always has to be a breaking down before there can be a building up. Because what gets built up in us, after a while goes toxic in our systems, just ends up being another barrier to us seeing truth. Because truly, every single moment is like the first moment. Every single moment is an opportunity to see things afresh, to see a new vista, a new facet of what God is trying to bring us. And if we aren't prepared for that, if we're all crusted over, if we're all full, then we can't grow anymore. And so this shape, this paschal shape, is continuous in our lives. It just continues to move. It's beautifully stated in Philippians. Take a look at what Paul says at Philippians 2. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, a domestic slave, and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. For this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the time of Jesus, at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. What he's showing us here is the same thing. There's always the descent, the emptying. If you've ever heard the word kenosis before, that is the Greek word that is translated here as emptying himself. This emptying, the descent, happened at his death, happened at his birth. It's a descent and then the ascent on the other side. Meister Eckhart, a famous medieval mystic, contemplative, said that the spiritual journey, the spiritual life, is much more about subtraction rather than addition. It's not about what we go out and acquire. It's about what we let go of so that we can see the next thing that's coming in. The church is always teaching us about ascent. It's forgotten about descent. Except our most ancient traditions, the ones that are still present in the Catholic tradition, that are still present in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, the Assyrian tradition, they still speak about descent. But the Protestant tradition, the European thread that came over to our continent, not so much. We need to be re-educated. We need to relearn that there's got to be this descent. And suffering is what takes us there. A descent before there is an ascent. You know, what we're talking about here is a rite of passage. Y'all heard of rite of passages before? We don't really have any in our culture anymore. You know, a baby's first tooth or a first haircut is not a rite of passage. It's a milestone, but it's not a rite of passage. You know, the bar mitzvah, the confirmation, the debutante ball, milestones, but they're not rite of passages. Because true rites of passage have to have three components to them. They have to have separation, transition, and reincorporation. If you think about the Aboriginal types of rites of passage, the walkabout is the most famous one that we would probably understand. Where a 12 or 13-year-old boy is taken out of the village, out of the company of the children and the women, by the men, into the bush, and made to go walkabout, made to travel for up to 6 months, over maybe 1,000 kilometers of wilderness, by himself, guided only by the song lines, the chants that his people have been reciting to themselves for 40 to 60,000 years, that give all the landmarks of the land. They're an internal mapping system that allows them to move, but it's not without risk. This boy has to be able to build his own shelters, to hunt, to trap, to know which plants will sustain him, which would kill him, which will bandage wounds. You know, he needs to know how to live off the land and how to make it over this time. And he uses his song lines not only to do that, but also to bring him back into the collective consciousness of his people, to see how he's connected to the moment and to the land and to everyone else who has also gone by the same way. And when he comes back, that's the transition. And it's risky, and it's difficult. And the pain of separation from leaving his mother and his friends and his siblings and everyone he's ever known contributes to the joy of the reincorporation when at the end of walkabout he's brought back and celebrated in the community now as a man and no longer a child. We don't have those anymore. They used to be built into the rites and the practices of the church, but we've lost those too. So we don't know when we're graduating to new phases of life. We don't know when we've moved from being a child, spiritually speaking, to being an adult. We have no way of knowing these things. But if we can get back to this pascal shape, this mystery, that's it. It's the descent. It's accepting the pain of separation, moving into the confusion, the turmoil of transition, and then coming back out the other side to be reconnected and reincorporated back where you started, but not the way you left. Changed. Knowing something that you didn't know before. And others knowing that change in you to see that there is a new relationship that we can have. You can't fill a full vessel. You can't do it. You have to empty first, then fill. Suffering is what empties our vessel, prepares us for a new life. It's the only way. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. What way? This way? This paschal way? This descent into an ascent? This being broken by the suffering that we embrace and we don't fight off anymore, making ourselves even more toxic and paranoid and neurotic? But moving through it, those steps of grieving, if you want to look at it that way, moving through the loss into another place, this is what Jesus is saying is the only way to Father, only way to be the kind of person who can be completely present, who has the fearless freedom to be able to let go of all of the barriers and all of the shields and everything that we use to protect ourselves for another day, all those programs for survival. Let go that allows us to see Father as Father really is. Now, having said this, I don't expect you to go look for any suffering. You don't need to do that. It will find you. Let's not get too Catholic about this, you know. It will find us. But when it does find us, once we understand the purpose, once we understand what's going on in this shape, suffering's place and purpose in our lives, it makes it easier to bear. And maybe like James, we can start to say that we count it all joy when we're faced with these difficulties because they are the opportunity for us to take the next leap in our growth. Maybe we won't exactly count them as friends. Maybe we won't celebrate because some of these things are going to hurt. They have to hurt. If they don't hurt, they don't do their job. That's why we don't wish for them. We don't go looking for them. But when they're there, how do we handle it? How do we move through? How we do says everything about who we are as a human being. To start to understand that nothing is ever lost. It only changes form. You know? Romans 8. God causes everything to work together for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. It's not lost. The thing that we most deeply think we've lost is not lost. We sense a separation from it. That causes the pain. But when we move through it, we move into a new place. How should we handle suffering? How should we move through it on a day-to-day basis? I wanted to leave you with this. It's a little letter, very short, by Brother Lawrence. And those of you who are not familiar with Brother Lawrence, he was a 17th century French monk. And when he first joined the order, he was very excited to be a monk, but because he was just a poor peasant with no real skills, they stuck him in the kitchen. And he was very resentful to be put in the kitchen. He wanted to do monk things. He wanted to be, I don't know, Gregorian chanting or whatever he wanted to do. But it wasn't this among the greasy pots and pans. But over the years, as he spent there, and it took him years, he realized that God was just as present in the kitchen as he was anywhere else. And after a point of time, he realized he felt God's presence even more securely in the kitchen because there he was of use. There he was doing something for his brothers. And then he quit all other forms of devotion, all other forms of religious practice except that which he was obligated by the rule of his house because he didn't need it anymore. He was going right to the source. He stopped seeing his spiritual director. Didn't need him anymore because he was going right to the source all day long. And in this letter, whoever has written him, a woman who is not a religious, but obviously she is suffering deeply, really going through something. And so Brother Lawrence is writing her to tell her, how can she go through her day dealing with this suffering? And this is what he writes. Madam, I feel very sorry for you. If you can leave the care of your affairs to Monsieur and Madame and busy yourself only with praying to God, you will overthrow the power that presently governs your life and replace it with a better power. He, God, does not require a great deal of us. All he asks is a little remembrance of him from time to time, a little worship. Sometimes we should ask for his grace, and sometimes we should offer him our sufferings. What does that mean, offer our sufferings? We used to do that. Also, we'd offer things up. What does it mean? No. I think what it simply means is to see the purpose in them, to see the reason that we are emptying, how that they are emptying us and preparing us for new life, preparing us for a new vista, a new way of dealing with things, to take us to that next level. In other words, not to be raging against the universe, not to be fretting, not to be thinking that you're cursed or that something's wrong with you because the suffering is here, but to offer them to God means to see the purpose and what can happen, that all things will work together for good if we continue to be called according to that purpose. See how that works? He says, just a little remembrance from time to time, a little worship. Sometimes we should ask for his grace. Sometimes we should offer him our sufferings. At other times, we ought to thank him for the grace he has given us and which he is working in us. In the midst of your work, console yourself with him as often as you can. During your meals and your conversations, lift your heart towards him from time to time. The slightest little remembrance will always be very pleasant to him. To do this, you do not need to shout out loud. He is closer than we think. We do not have to be constantly in church to be with God. We can make our heart a prayer room into which we can retire from time to time to converse with him gently, humbly, and lovingly. Everyone is capable of these familiar conversations with God, some more, some less. He knows what our capabilities are. Let us begin, for perhaps he is only awaiting a generous resolve on our part. Take courage, for we have little time left to live. You are almost 64 years old, and I am approaching 80. Let us live and die with God. Our sufferings will always be sweeter and more pleasant when we are with him. And without him, our greatest pleasure will be but a cruel torture. May he be blessed by all. Amen. So make it a habit, little by little, to worship him in this way. Ask him for his grace and offer him your heart from time to time during the day, in the midst of your work, at every moment if you are able. Do not constrain yourself by rules or private devotions. Offer him your heart in faith with love and humility. You can assure Monsieur and Madame and Mademoiselle that I am offering my poor prayers for them and that I am their servant and yours in particular in our Lord. Brother Lawrence, I hope that you could hear the letter of a broken man. Someone who has not been through what we're talking about doesn't write that way, doesn't have that humility, doesn't have that sense of things. The simple, patient coming back to presence, coming back to God in the midst of our sufferings, and some of them are so bad they take your breath away, but that doesn't change the way that we can move through them so that we can continue to be people that can act and choose and relate in ways that continue to bring everyone together who is in our circle of concern. That's what we're after. Let the suffering do its work, empty us, show us the new thing that needs to be showed, and continue to move through in connection. And we're there. Jesus said, that's kingdom. That's who you really are. And we'll know that for ourselves. Let's pray. Father, for those of us who are going through difficulties right now, who are really suffering, we just offer them all up to you. We ask for healing, if healing is possible. We ask for restoration, for that can take place. But mostly, we just ask for exactly what Brother Lawrence is encouraging us to do, which is continue to connect with you. Father, help us to see our suffering, our difficulties, as the emptying that happens before the ascent back into connection with you and with each other. Help us to see how that it plays a vital part in our lives so that we don't shut it down. We don't necessarily celebrate it, but we don't fight it anymore. We allow it to move through us and take us where we really need to go. Thank you for being our God, Lord. Thank you for knowing infinitely what we need before we can even conceive, and for taking us where we need to be. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.